I want your soul.
I'll probably never see my 8-year-old daughter ever again. It's possible to type those words, to feel them on my tongue, to comprehend them in a literal sense, but to understand them, impossible. She's been gone somewhere between 14 and 24 hours. I tucked her in at 9 p.m., watched TV for 2 hours, and then hit the sack myself. When I went in to wake her up at 7 a.m., her first floor window was open, and she was gone. There was only a minimal splash of blood on the sheets, but it's my only child's blood, and she was in fear as it spilled. So the thought of the sight of it is enough to make me faint. The police suspected and dismissed me with all due haste. It makes sense to question the sole living parent, but with no history of violence or social service calls, there was no reason to pursue me. To be fair, they listened to my concerns about Liam Hesch. But to be honest, I'm not very concerned about what's fair. That bastard took my daughter, and they're going to let him get away with it. I had been noticing subtle hints that Penny's happiness had been draining like water from a sink. "Hey," I remember saying with increasing frequency, "where's my smile?" When that didn't work, "Penny, for your thoughts?" was always certain to get a chuckle. That was true even when all four of her front baby teeth were missing at once, and she would walk around with her mouth buttoned shut for everyone but me. It was truly an innocent time. But over the past month, it had failed to work. It took weeks for her to begin opening up about her elementary school PE teacher. "Daddy," she offered tentatively over meatloaf and mashed potatoes one night. Her favorite dish, by the way. "How come Mr. Hesch can make me feel like I'm being touched just by looking at me?" I hate myself now. Because in that moment, I couldn't think of a single thing to say. My daughter's file had gone missing from the school's office. We discovered this 6 hours after I reported her missing. But dozens of people had had access, and without knowing when the file had been stolen, it would be impossible to seek alibis from every single one. The police questioned Liam Hesch specifically because of my suspicions. I saw him go into and out of the interrogation room. He was a creepy motherfucker with tiny hands and steel gray eyes that didn't understand proper social conventions. He stared at me far too long on his way into the room, and his tongue was far too busy on his lips. With no evidence, however, the police had no choice but to let him go. I received a phone call at 7:13 p.m. At first, there was only breathing. When he spoke, I recognized the voice right away. "Leave me alone now, Daniel. It'll make it easier on her if you'll leave me alone now." There was quiet sobbing in the background. I could hear her sobbing. And then there was more breathing. "I'm gonna destroy this phone now, Daniel. Leave me alone. Go away." I heard the soft, wet smacking sound of a tongue that was far too busy with a pair of lips. And then the line went dead. I stared at the phone in my hands. For a moment, I did nothing. I had three options. The first was to call the police. but I had no proof that Liam Hash had been the other one on the line. And I had no doubt that his phone was a burner. Without any fresh evidence, there wasn't any reason to force a search warrant or to arrest him a second time. Not after he had already been released. So this was problematic. The second was to follow his advice and do nothing. If you're a parent, you'll understand that the second option was not really an option. The third was to take advantage of the fact that Liam Hash did not know my experience as a computer programmer, and that afforded me some very practical yet extra-legal connections in the telecom industry. By 7:19 p.m., I'd found exactly where the burner phone had pinged. I don't know anything about combat. I don't have any friends who would die or even fight for me. I don't know how to use my father's ancient hunting rifle, or why I bothered to keep his rusty Bowie knife. And I don't know if I'll ever see my daughter again. I do know that Penny might see me die in front of her, and that is an acceptable risk to me. The night is going to burn a long, slow blaze. It is going to burn, and all collateral damage has implicitly accepted its fate by standing between me and my daughter. My plans were as practical as they were bold, but 7 years as a programmer had left me ill-equipped to deal with a revenge spree. Still, I wasn't an idiot, and Liam Hash was a total fucking idiot. I tried to keep telling myself that. Tried to keep from shaking. But parking my practical 2006 Honda Civic 3 blocks from shit central, then dropping my hunting knife on the ground, then splitting the seam of my good khakis as I bent down to retrieve it, did not make me feel like Angus MacGyver getting ready to make some heads roll. I stealthily and quickly cantered down the rows of industrial warehouses. It was pretty stereotypical to kidnap a kid and then hide her near a shipping yard. But our Pennsylvania lake town was lousy with them, and Liam Hash ticked every box on the creeper checklist. I was 80% certain that he owned at least one clown costume, and he lived in his dead mother's tract home. I crept into the southeast corner of the warehouse that had registered his location 23 minutes prior. And yes, for the record, your phone can be tracked with pinpoint accuracy. You have no idea just how many foiled terrorist plots and dead civilian children have learned that the hard way. However horrifying you imagine an empty warehouse to be at night, I want you to double that. I snuck through an open window, balancing the rifle awkwardly in my hand as I went through, and emerged into the dark. It was all-encompassing and completely overwhelming. I shuffled through with my hands in front of me, not daring to click the flashlight that I had stored in my back pocket. Somewhere ahead of me was a lunatic, and my only hope, my daughter's only chance, was to catch him off guard. Every fiber of my being told me to turn around, to get out of the dark, to avoid the silence that was so overpowering it clung to my arm like cobwebs. But what point would there be in turning back? Without my daughter, there was nothing left at home. I didn't particularly envy the slow prospect of watching the years tick down, knowing that the best part of my life was forever behind me. I needed hope. That's when I cracked my shin so hard against a metal pipe that the echo hurt my ears. I fell to the ground in agony, clutching a leg that was now coated in blood. And several things happened at once. A single light bulb twitched on. My instincts told me to look around, no matter how much pain my leg was enduring. I could see him floating in my vision as my eyes watered in pain, wearing a scowl of anger. Liam Hash stared at me far too long with steel gray eyes. My heart was torn with both hope and fear as I realized that Penny was right next to him, right next to me, tied to a thick pipe. Her wrists were bound together in front of her, and she was standing upright. She was terrified. My heart wanted to explode. I saw the knife in front of me, The rifle was nowhere in sight, though. I hadn't even begun to lunge for it when Liam Hash stopped me.
Now, Daniel. Stay where you are. It's not your own safety that you need to worry about.
He then lifted a metal baseball bat up to Penny's face and shook his head slowly. His tongue was far too busy for his lips.
I need you to slide that little knife over to me now, Daniel.
He then bent down and sniffed Penny's hair, and she winced. I tried to convince myself that there had to be another way, but there was no other way. I crawled over to the knife. Little fireworks of pain exploded through my shin every time I bumped the ground. I reached out and gently slid the weapon forward along the floor. Liam Hash stopped it by raising the steel toe of his boot and bringing it down upon the blade. I was unarmed.
Listen to me now, Daniel. You ruined everything. Everything. How can I enjoy my time here when I know you won't leave me alone? My plans have changed now.
My eyes, which were already tearing over from the pain of my shin, began to overflow with emotional anguish as well.
Just give her back. I don't care what else you gotta do, just please.
Penny looked down at me, and I could see her beginning to weep silently. I was failing as a father, and she watched me break. Liam Hash looked down at me like I was something he'd scraped off his shoe after a stroll through the poop factory.
It's not what I do, Daniel. It's what you will do.
I stared up at him in confused hatred. I wondered briefly if I could stand without buckling under the pain of my bleeding shin.
What are you talking about?
He flashed me a disgusted smile.
Little Leonard Pridditch, classmate of your soft Penny.
Parents are Sterling and Missy, who have more money than God intended for 10 honest men.
You must bring him to me.
He then bent down and stared at Penny. She winced, but stayed in place like she was terrified of the consequences that came with disobedience. He stood back and looked at me once again, tongue still far, far too busy outside his mouth.
We might as well drop all the pretenses now, Dan.
My blood boiled. It simply wasn't right. His idea was a non-starter. A trade? There would be no way I would kidnap a child.
You can give me back my daughter, or I'm going to shove a used needle up your ass, I said.
I felt bold, strong. What would he possibly say to that? He then brought the bat down with incredible speed. The crack of bones seemed to echo forever. It took several seconds for me to register screaming that was so loud and so terrible that it wove into the very fabric of the air. Penny's lower arm was bent like she had a second elbow. Her screams of agony melted layer after layer of my own self-worth, discarded upon the floor like so much snakeskin.
Daniel, Liam Hash screamed.
I realized dimly that I had been screaming too, but was physically held in place by some incomprehensible force. I realized abruptly that the force was the half-realized threat that Liam Hash still presented to Penny. His baseball bat was held aloft, as though he was ready to smash her skull like a watermelon.
Listen to me, Daniel.
I stopped, and Penny continued, though it was beginning to dissolve into a low, guttural warble. Liam Hash was breathing heavily with his effort.
You will bring Leonard to me before morning.
The machines in this warehouse will start of their own accord 1 hour before the first workers arrive.
If you do not have that boy here to me by then, Daniel, then I will act as though you have failed.
He bent down, dropped the bat, and unlocked Penny's handcuffs. Trembling, she fell into his arms. He squatted and snatched the hunting knife from the floor, aiming its tip at Penny's eyeballs. I was crying openly now, but dared not say anything. What words did I have? I'm going to leave now, he explained icily, walking backward towards the shadows. You have 4 hours. Bring the boy now and come alone, or your daughter will pay the price if you don't. I continued to sob silently. Penny's face said everything. She wanted me to fix things, to make them better for her, like I had for the last 8 years of my life. She didn't understand why I didn't follow her and why I couldn't move. The look of overwhelming betrayal on her face was the last thing I saw before she was swallowed up into darkness. With Penny gone, there was only silence. The absence of sound reverberated deep inside me. I thought of life without my daughter and whether I would care about dying myself. We all die. Some die earlier than others. That much is inevitable. Murder is only considered evil because we convince ourselves that we might actually live for forever. It's amazing what we're capable of believing when fear becomes absolute. With frightening calm, I fumbled around until I found the rifle in the dark. Then I stood up and limped out of the warehouse in search of little Leonard Pridditch. Part of me was already dead. It was the only reason I was able to keep my wits about me as I crept onto the grounds of the Pridditch place in the middle of the night, fully intending to do something awful. I wish there had been crickets, floodlights, anything, something. There was nothing but darkness and silence as I approached the northeast corner of the home. It was a very still night, and I was afraid of myself. I assumed that not every first floor window would be locked. I mean, be honest, do you check every one of your windows at night? And I was right. I snuck into a dark dining room. The feeling of violation was palpable as I crept through the quiet house, but it was not nearly enough for me to turn back. Without Penny, there was nothing. And so I moved forward. After finding the stairs, I slowly snuck along their edge in hopes of avoiding any untimely creaks. I found myself in the upstairs hall. To the right was a single closed door, and I assumed it was the parents' room. On the left side, one door was open enough to see a nightlight inside. The soft glow was sufficient to reveal that it was a bathroom. Across from the open door was a closed one with a cardboard Tyrannosaurus head that read, "Danger, feeding time," taped to the outside. I assumed that it was a child's room. The thought of Penny's princess barking only, all others will be towed sign flashed across my mind. It hung on her bedroom door, too. Would I throw it in the trash if she died? That thought was enough to spur me on. I tiptoed to the kid's room. I'd left the rifle in the car. If it came down to a fight, it was over. All would be lost. There was no point in shooting Mom and Dad. The door creaked as I pushed it into the dark room. I waited. The soft sound of Leonard's breathing drifted through. He was still asleep. Perfect. My heart was beating hard enough to make me physically ill. I kept waiting for him to wake up, to scream, for my life to end. I closed the distance and then was standing over his bed. I had made it. To be honest, I hadn't believed it would be possible. I think that's the only fact that had kept me moving forward. Yet here I was. I waited for little Leonard to exhale, then I clamped a hand down on his face. And for a moment, nothing happened. And then his eyes shot open. "Listen very carefully if you want to live," I hissed. His face felt so tiny and frail. "Nod if you understand." And I lifted my hand. He stared at me in complete terror. The whites of his eyes seemed to glow of their own accord, and Leonard nodded. I exhaled. Good, I said curtly. Do not make a single sound, or my friend will shoot your parents. He's in the room now. Throw on your shoes and a jacket. We're leaving. I felt like the world's biggest piece of shit as he followed my commands. He was trembling as he fumbled with his shoelaces. I said nothing. I kept my hand over his mouth as we snuck back down the stairs and towards the dining room window. He could have ended it all with a scream, but fortunately, he wasn't that bold. Leonard struggled as he tried to lift his 8-year-old frame out of the window. I had to help him with a boost. He flinched at my touch and toppled backwards out into the night. I quickly slid through and landed on the ground right next to him. When Penny was 4, she was terrified of the playground slide. She always made me hold her in my lap as the ground rushed up to meet us, but would giggle when I landed and lifted her high above my head. You're old enough to slide all by yourself, I kept telling her. Be brave for Dad. But she would reach for my hand. My heart would melt, and I would carry her to the top once again. The day she finally told me that she could slide all alone was the day I became terrified of what would happen. She boldly climbed each step, then turned back to smile at me when she was halfway up the ladder. Penny pulled one hand away from the handled wave and then toppled to the ground. The fall knocked out one of her baby teeth. When she finished crying, Penny was able to articulate an apology. I'm sorry, Dad, she heaved. I tried to be brave for you, but I fell when you weren't there to hold me. I'm sorry, Leonard whispered as he stared up at me in complete fear. Please don't hurt me. I wanted to cry, but there was simply no time for that. I reached down and took his hand in my own. Yanking him firmly to his feet, I turned and began a brisk walk toward my car. I did not let go of him. I threw little Leonard into the back seat, then pulled my car away from his home as quietly as possible. I did not make him use his seatbelt. I didn't say anything at all for a time. We were halfway back to the docks when I pulled the car to the side of the road. The night was still painfully silent as I stepped out of the car and walked purposefully to the trunk. This silence angered me. There should have been bugs performing for all the night to hear, but even they didn't want to be heard near me. I took a deep breath, opened the trunk, and pulled out the rifle. The slam of the closing trunk reverberated in the silence. I think that it scared Leonard. At any rate, he was shaking when I opened his door. Get out, I commanded. He didn't hesitate, and he didn't take his eyes off my gun. He stood in front of me in silence for just a moment. Part of me wished that a cop car would find me here and end everything. I stared down at Leonard with all the intensity that I could muster. You need to listen very carefully to everything I say. He stared back at me in unmoving awe. I then thrust the rifle into his hands. There is a very bad man who is trying to kill my daughter. And I can only save her with your help, Leonard. You need to know that he's been planning to hurt you and steal from your parents as well. Now, we can all be safe, but only if you're extremely brave. I then handed him a box of bullets, which he accepted limply. Can you be brave for me, Leonard? I have an ex-brother-in-law. He married my sister. God rest and bless her soul, against our deepest desires and wishes for her, and became an unspoken, unwelcomed part of the family. For a few years, I found great distaste in him and his lack of motivation. He seemed fragile, and for a man living in the harsh Pennsylvania town we hail from, he seemed to radiate a particular sort of uselessness. Family gatherings were always awkward, since no one on my side of the family really had anything in common with him. He was, for all intents and purposes, the real outsider to our clan. We were absolutely shocked when our sister started dating him. We were even more flabbergasted when she said yes to his proposal. And we were completely floored when they chose to have a child. My sister had a difficult pregnancy, but Penny eventually became the center of our universe. And we finally had something we could bond with Daniel about. You see, we are a God-fearing, military-supporting, conservative, Republican family, even my sister. Daniel seemed a bit left of center, but more so seemed to choose to flow through his life wishy-washy on the fence. We'd ask him about certain opinions and stances, and his reply would always be non-committal and avoided. Once Penny arrived in her glorious infancy, we put aside our differences and adored our sweet little angel. Unfortunately, my sister passed away. I won't get into details, but it caused a sort of rift in our relationships. Daniel wanted to remain the doting father, and my parents, Penny's grandparents, wanted to relieve him of the burden of single fatherhood. He refused to listen, though, and dove his existence into rearing Penny. We were all offended, but eventually found a softness in our hearts when we would see her. She fixed our broken hearts, mending us together in an eternal way. I love her more than I imagined I ever could, my niece. And as I continued to interact with Daniel and Penny, I realized that my adoration is a mere fraction of Daniel's. He loves her dearly, like any father would. His devotion to her is palpable. I am younger than him by a few years, and instead of joining the human race of the nuclear family like my sister did, I joined the Army. I served for almost 5 years before being retired out medically for severe injuries sustained in combat. Mentally, physically, and emotionally, I'm a complete disaster. I sleep a few hours a week. Yeah, a week. And find myself constantly vigilant and paranoid. When I do sleep, my nightmares are brutal and devastating. I often find myself donning my prosthetic leg and drive around the town, listening to late-night talk radio, focused on right-wing perspectives. Occasionally, I find myself at Daniel and Penny's home and desire to feel her healing comfort warm my bosom. She is my only constant source of positivity since I got out, and I gravitate towards her without conscious effort. I found myself driving aimlessly this morning, early, and happened upon their home. I witnessed Daniel hobbling around, bleeding from his shin, throwing something in his trunk. He looked panicked and flustered. I started to get out of my car, but he hurriedly maneuvered his into the street and barreled off and away. I decided to follow him. He went to a strange house, and I watched as he circled the place, trying windows, and eventually found a way inside. My curiosity and fear took hold of me, but I hesitantly waited and watched. When a small boy, maybe 7 or 8, plopped out of the window, followed closely by Daniel, my real interest peaked and peaked. The kid looked absolutely terrified. I followed them, away from the suburbs towards the industrial area of our city, and was startled when he suddenly parked on the side of the road. He got out, reached in his trunk, and grabbed the rifle he stowed away inside. I had no idea what the city was doing, but I had to act. I had to do something before that boy got hurt. I grabbed my .45. I always carried it, and I shuffled as fast as a one-legged man could towards them. Daniel was oblivious to my presence. As I made my way closer, I racked my firearm, letting my Hornady Defense hollow point cartridge slide smoothly and graciously into the barrel and race towards them. I knew the bullet would kill him, and I started to feel the addictive push of adrenaline flow through my cursed veins. I was about to yell and command him to halt, getting him to leave the boy in some safety, when he handed the boy the rifle and begged the young lad to help him rescue Penny.
Daniel, what the fuck are you doing?
I growled at him. He may have shit his pants when my demand scared him. I'll never know. But he did jump about 5 feet into the air and gasped a panicked wheeze. He then proceeded to tell me everything about what happened to Penny, including that bastard Liam breaking her fragile, delicate, innocent arm with a bat. I was a medic in the army, and part of my duty consisted of treating the wounds of war criminals before and after interrogation. Although I never saw the damaging blows that caused the wounds, my mind fantasized about the real binary brutality it required, and had spent many moments over the years planning and preparing if I had to ever interrogate or torture someone. I got a few ideas of how we can handle this, Daniel. Are you ready? Because I'm not fucking around. I smiled a greasy, angst-ridden foul grin and stared directly into his wide pupils, waiting for the go-ahead to set my plan in motion. Before Daniel could answer me, brave little Leonard answered. For Penny, we should all get our hands dirty. He smiled a similar mischievous grin as mine, pulled the bolt on the rifle Daniel handed him, and bore his eager eyes into Daniel. Pretty ballsy for an 8-year-old kid, I must say. I looked back at Daniel, anticipating a response in my favor. Can you be brave for me, Leonard? I asked him breathlessly. Some distant part of my mind knew that I was going to hell for this. Kidnapping an 8-year-old and telling him to murder a grown man wasn't going to look good on my permanent record when I stood in front of the pearly gates. A lot of souls were going to be damned tonight, and that much was inevitable. Little Leonard opened his mouth to speak, but an adult's voice filled the air.
Daniel, what the fuck are you doing?
I stared at Leonard in confusion before registering the look of terror in his eyes. I spun around to see a pistol aimed at my head. I'm not going to lie, I pissed my pants a little. Because what I was seeing was impossible. Boring into me was the crazed face of Clyde. Losing my wife was more painful than I have the ability to articulate. The anguish was enough to convince me, in a dark yet certain place, that the death of Penny would extinguish what little of my soul remained. The human mind can only endure so much before accepting self-destruction as the only form of self-preservation. It's why the deepest part of me knew immediately that I would do whatever it took to keep Penny alive. But losing my wife's family wasn't really a sacrifice. It actually made the healing process easier. They weren't so easy to be around, and I don't think they really liked me. I did actually feel sorry for her brother Clyde. He had lost more than just his leg before coming home. But sympathy was the furthest thing from my mind as I stared down the barrel of the gun he was aiming at my head. His eyes were darting back and forth. I figured that I had 2, maybe 3 seconds to explain my admittedly awkward situation before the proverbial fan created shit confetti. Hey, Clyde. Could you put the gun down? And suddenly, I got very bold. You know, I never showed much appreciation for your enthusiasm about firearms. I choked down my nervousness and smiled. There was simply no time for anything other than what derived the most practical result. Please put the gun down. I spoke faster than I ever had before. When I'd finished, God help us, Clyde and I had never understood each other better. I have a few ideas of how we can handle this, Daniel. Are you ready? He asked, spittle flying into the night. I took a deep breath, mind racing about how to best answer. and I sighed. Leonard did it for me. For Penny, we should all get our hands dirty. Then he pulled the bolt back like a veteran, and both of them looked at me. Let's all go to hell. I strode confidently into the warehouse. I was alone. Liam Hesh was standing in a solitary patch of light. He had a knife to my daughter's throat. Part of me died at the sight of it, but a bigger part dismissed this fact as internal collateral damage and moved forth with icy precision. Her arm was crooked and her face was gray. I would cry about it later, but disregarded the observations as mere background information for the moment. Analyzing the situation at hand was crucial. I stood about 20 feet from the pair. They were standing next to the shadow cast by a large, gear-driven machine that looked like a paddle wheel. I took this in all at once. I looked around cautiously before speaking. I brought Leonard with me, I offered, raising a young boy's Guardians of the Galaxy shirt. You can have him when Penny's safe. I spoke with more authority than I felt. He smiled, but it was clouded with so much anger.
You think I'm an idiot, Daniel?
He shook his head condescendingly.
I know when I'm being flanked.
In one fluid motion, he reached his arm behind his waistband and produced a large pistol. He pointed it off to my left and fired. Clyde screamed in sheer agony, bastard though he was. It actually brought tears to my eyes. And then he was silent. Liam Hash shook his head. The closest that I can get to describing what I felt in that moment is that I was sure my ass cheeks would freeze shut. Everything was lost. Why'd you have to ruin it, Daniel? You could have spared your daughter if you had played my game. Hesh raised his knife and brought it down towards Penny's chest. She didn't even have time to flinch. The gunshot missed its mark, but it was close enough. This one came from the shadows of my right, and Hesh hadn't noticed his flank after all. Leonard had blown out Liam's right elbow. He dropped the pistol to the ground and howled in rage, but the other arm still held the knife. Furious, he lifted it high above his head. I didn't hesitate this time. I was running before I even thought about it. By leaping through the air, I was able to reach Liam just before the knife landed on Penny's cheek. I had two choices. I could either dive at the knife, which would block his jab temporarily. Alternatively, it was possible to tackle him to the ground, but that would mean that he'd still be armed. I chose the latter. I could feel the knife sliding into my torso as we crashed to the floor. It parted my skin like butter, and the pain was too much. He screamed in efficient fury as he rolled me over and laid his hands on my throat. My strength was pouring out of my side. It was warm and wet. He was more powerful than I was, and I could feel it as I clawed limply at his broad shoulders. He was simply stronger. My neck hurt, my side hurt. Flames of pure charcoal, filtered pain seared both parts of my body. I wanted the agony to end. The pain then watered down. Everything did. It got quiet. It was kind of nice. Liam's hands were strong, and I closed my eyes. Let's all go to hell, a melancholy Daniel replied. With that, we established a dual flanking pattern in order to catch Liam off guard. I would come around the back to the south of the warehouse. Leo would sneak in the north side, and Daniel would boldly enter and move with confidence right into the lion's den. We took off Leo's pajama top, a mosaic of Star-Lord, Groot, Rocket, and Gamora, and the wrestler guy. What's his name? Whatever. It referenced some hip and violent movie I haven't seen yet. Daniel moved with some confidence, creating the perfect distraction as he noisily entered the warehouse. He loudly announced his presence, which allowed Leo and I to sneak into the scene with relative ease. I could see the encounter occur. Liam held my precious Penny, my sweet niece who I adore wholeheartedly, with a menacing grip, a shiny tight blade pressed against her neck. He held her, and from my angle, I could see everything he was doing. I imagine if I hadn't seen that moral depravity, I wouldn't have made the mistake. Until that moment, I had been as silent and smooth as cotton in a breeze. They were speaking, and I wish I was paying attention. I could have telegraphed Liam as he reached behind himself, grasped his pistol, aimed it, and fired at me. The anger boiled my blood in my head. I wanted the opportunity to kill this motherfucker. I craved it. It wasn't until I felt the sting of the round pierce into my abdomen before I checked back into reality. A few years ago, in Afghanistan, I was a combat medic for the U.S. Army. I was assigned to the scout platoon of my unit, a merely managed militia of military menace. I worked hand in hand with the trained and cold-heartedness of brutality. We were often tasked with capture and interrogation of war criminals. Any more details and I may violate confidence and put good on his soldiers at risk. We would breach known hostile structures and grab our expected targets. There was a lot of spy game I was never aware of. I was the medic, that's all I did. I spent a lot of time and resources cleaning up the wounds of interrogation, and that's all I can say about that. You think Gitmo is bad? Leave a known terrorist cell leader alone in a room with some years deployed special unit, and tell me waterboarding is still awful. One day, after many months into my second deployment, we were tasked by COC to extract another target. It was normal, par for the course. We prepared the exact same way. When the ambush started, I was lucky enough to be injured by an RPG that hit the dirt a few feet away from me as I got out of the FLA. I never really felt the pain in my leg as it was blown off. That was the grace. The real pain came from the burning afterwards. My DCUs caught fire above the blast amputation and burnt my bleeding stump to a charcoal crisp. As the painful searing commenced, I found a limit to my pain. After screaming in agony, I eventually couldn't scream anymore. I just laid there, mouth agape, lungs empty of air, while mentally processing the damage. The smell of cooking flesh is much more enticing than the reek of burnt flesh. Amidst the intense pain, I laughed at the thought of my muscles and fats cooking off into a tasty steak. Luckily, the burn cauterized the amputation enough to stunt bleeding. When the enemy combatants moved in to fire at close range and execute my friends, that's when the real panic set in. A lot of us were severely injured. Shrapnel and bullets peppered all of us, and thankfully another larger unit was close by and came in to secure our position. It took them a few minutes. I was shot in the face by an enemy, but the aim was off. It ricocheted off my cheek, only scarring my face minimally. Damn. It was my good looks that got me the girls, I thought. Liam's bullet hit me hard in the gut, and I screamed as the ground burned through my insides. I fell down, dropping to my knees and then by my side. I held compress on the wound with my left hand, still keeping my pistol in my right. I lost the element of surprise in my ambush, but that was maybe enough for Leo to still be brave. I bit my tongue and kept my noises to absolute minimum. I needed Liam to think I was down for good. I lost my visual vantage and couldn't see what was happening. I heard some shuffling and then a shot from a rifle. The echo rang out, rattled my head, and brought me back to the desert. I felt the panic rise, and I felt my heart pound in fear. I heard Penny squeak in both pain and terror, and then I heard Daniel scream in agony. I gritted my teeth, pulled my strength, and slowly raised back up. I saw Penny had been knocked away from Liam and was nursing a sore head. She had struck the machinery behind her as well as she fell away from them. I watched as Liam stabbed Daniel and forced him to the ground. The whole scene was horrifying. Daniel's blood loss starting to spray and pool, his leg injury bleeding profusely. He still fought on, though. His increasingly weaker arms waved about wildly, striking Liam as hard as pillows. And I watched as Liam bent down, took control, and started to choke the life out of him. I've watched a man choke another man to death. Twice, actually. It's not like the movies. It takes a few minutes, sometimes up to 10, to actually choke somebody to death. What is shown in movies is the person merely passing out from blood loss to the brain. Once this happens, rookie killers assume that their prey is done. In all reality, after the blood starts to flow again, the unconscious can wake in 20 to 30 seconds, only experiencing a minor lapse in time. The two occasions I had seen a real choking to death included a mismanaged capital punishment and a hands-on murder. The death penalty was assessed to a man in Kabul for reasons I'm not aware of. He had been in prison for months before his execution date. Part of a good hanging is knowing how much the person weighs, so the proper length drop can be achieved for proper neck breakage. The man had lost considerable weight in his last week of lockup, enough to allow his fall distance to be too short, which caused his neck to be strained, but not broken. With his hands tied, he choked and choked and choked. He struggled and fought for any relief, any satisfaction, but no one was allowed to help. It took about 7 minutes of his struggling to finally kill him. The rope slowed his airway enough for a slow oxygen starvation death. The other strangulation happened in the surgery tent I was assigned to right after the assault where I lost my leg. I was being treated by our unit PA, and he was interrupted by another casualty, an enemy combatant. The PA looked at me, and back at the bleeding man, and then back at me. We made eye contact for a moment, and I wheezed out a stiff disapproval. He assessed me again, and apparently decided I was stable enough to attend to the raghead. I watched in panicked agony, thinking he was treating that animal with more intent than I, which reflected well on Geneva Convention mandates for medical personnel, but was satisfied when the PA crawled on top of the guy, straddling his arms under his knees, and started to choke him. With the blood loss, the shock, and now airway blockage, the raghead barely struggled to keep his own life. Once he succumbed to oxygen loss, passing out after a minute, the PA failed to relent his grip. He held tightly for what felt like an eternity, and after he seemed satisfied, he released his grip and checked for a pulse. He nodded to himself and then removed his latex gloves and donned a fresh pair. He looked at me. Again, our eyes met. But this time, a simple nod from me was promise enough. I saw the fight diminish in Daniel's arms as Liam held him down. His arms fell limp to his side, and I saw his eyes drift close. I was hurting bad, but I needed to intervene. I mustered my strength and slowly shuffled my way towards the mangled mess of men. When Penny had fallen off the slide, time got all wobbly. It happened in impossibly rapid slow motion, leaving me to consider every terrible outcome without any hope of intervention. I wondered in sequence if she would break her arm, her hand, before finally realizing that her face would take the brunt of the impact. I stood waiting for the sound of a watermelon hitting the floor when I heard a crack. The grip on my throat slackened, and a wave of sobering air rushed into my lungs. I coughed and waved my arms wildly before focusing on the form in front of me. Penny stood, wide-eyed, with Liam Hesh's gun in her hands. The monster himself was in the fetal position, hands clutching his bleeding scalp, and realization came all at once. Penny had pistol-whipped him and saved my life. I struggled to my knees, still grasping for air. The man was down, but not out, so we couldn't afford to celebrate quite yet. There was still plenty more opportunities to mess this up. I spun wildly around in search of Leonard. I hate to say it, but I knew I'd leave the kid behind if it meant getting my daughter to safety. And I think any other father would agree. But I wasn't entirely giving up on him quite yet. He was standing just out of sight, shaking like a leaf. We had distracted Liam long enough to get the kid within about 10 feet of the bastard. Leonard had still missed his target, but it was enough to save Penny's life. I staggered over to him, who looked like he'd shit his pants some time ago. My stumbling over to his hiding spot like the world's angstiest zombie clearly wasn't helping his nerves, but that was a problem for his future therapist. After all, his parents were very rich. "Take Penny and run," I shouted into his face before collapsing to my knees. I grabbed his tiny biceps and screamed at him. Then I spun him and pushed him towards Penny with all my strength. "Both of you," I coughed violently, and then fell to my hands. Screaming had taken it out of me. My shin was damaged, and I had not recovered from the edge of unconsciousness that I endured after Liam's strangulation. I knew I wasn't going to sprint my way out of there. Slow footsteps then approached me. They came to rest calmly in front of my gaze. "Oh, Daniel. I'm not happy with you now." I coughed. A splatter of blood landed on the floor. A gentle hum then kicked in, and the paddle-wheeled machine slowly began to grind forth. My mind felt fuzzy. Liam Hash bent down and grabbed my neck. The world turned red and hot. He lifted me to my feet. I felt like I was being stabbed in the thigh. He brought his face within an inch of mine. His breath smelled like seaweed.
"Do you know what happens now, Daniel?"
"A cold shower, please," piped a voice from behind us. Liam Hash pivoted to face the sound and paid for his choice by centering his face directly into Clyde's fist. Liam dropped me, and for the second time that night, I felt a burning rush of air return to my lungs. I dimly registered a violent clang as Liam Hash backed his skull into the gears behind him. He collapsed to his knees, hands grabbing blindly at his bleeding head. Clyde, pale and covering his bleeding torso, stepped into the light. He looked like death warmed over. "Anything to calm down that disgusting pervert," he said. I realized, with a distant revulsion, what had been stabbing my thigh. I followed Clyde's gaze to examine Liam Hash. He was lying prone, hands out in front of himself, jerking his body from side to side. He was stuck. Both feet were caught in the gears. And the pistol had landed just in front of his fingertips, and he almost grasped it. My sense of balance was barely intact enough to remain standing, but Clyde was already on the move. With three quick steps, he strode over to Liam's reach and kicked the gun away. Then he bent down, right hand still covering his own bullet wound, and pulled Liam up by the hair with his left. Liam winced to Clyde and began to sputter.
I shot you, you asshole.
Clyde laughed heartily. "You really think that's the first time I've been shot?" Liam Hash stared at him, arms flapping weakly. Clyde shook his head.
"Don't ever tread on me, motherfucker."
And then Clyde slammed Liam's head on the ground with a deafening thunk. Clyde stood up to walk away, and Liam groping sadly after him.
"Wait, wait," Liam wailed.
For a fraction of a second, the tone of his voice actually elicited a quantum of pity from me. He bubbled and then began to cry.
"Please, please help me, please."
Tears streamed down his face. I looked at Clyde, struggling to maintain my balance. And he glanced back at me and smirked. Hash screamed in agony. It echoed off the walls.
"My feet are getting crushed. Please just pull me out. My feet are getting crushed."
Clyde laughed. It was quiet at first, but slowly gained in intensity until it was as loud as Liam's scream had been.
"You want to know what the funny thing is?"
he shouted, and Liam looked up at him in unadulterated terror. Those gears will be the perfect tourniquet. You'll be alive for hours. Liam's eyes dilated like he was giving birth to two twin gorillas. His final scream made me grab my ears in pain, but it wasn't enough to drown out the sound of that man's sorrow. Then, with a sickening crunch, the gears ate another half inch of the legs of Liam Hash. Clyde's still a jerk, but he's family, and we found a way to keep the peace. He's been picking up Penny from school every day since the incident, and I think it's been good for him to have purpose and regularity in his life. Structure's good for everybody. The Pertich family was indeed rich enough to pay for little Leonard's therapy, and he's doing quite well. Honestly, the kid's reputation in the community has skyrocketed since he saved Penny's life. He's going to be insanely popular with his peers as a teenager. He's a tough kid. Interestingly enough, the boy's official police statement explained that Liam Hash was entirely alone when he kidnapped little Leonard from his family's home. With no other apparent witnesses to the contrary, the kidnapping case was closed. Penny bounced back with humor and grace. The resemblance to her mother is so profoundly striking that I can't decide whether I'm filled with pain or gratitude on any given day. I'm doing better than I have in some time. It took a seismic jolt to my consciousness to realize how depressed I had been after my wife's death, and how I'd buried everything so deep that my mind had tricked itself. Turns out that mental illness is far more commonplace than either the healthy or the sick could possibly realize. And I'm not here to judge anybody. That's just the way it is. And the school district has overhauled its hiring policy in the wake of Liam Hesh's scandal. Funny enough, most people don't like being grabbed against their will, if you could imagine that. It was also discovered that a lot of people weren't taking the issue as seriously as they should have been, if you can imagine that. In any event, it's an opinion worth hearing. Because if I learned nothing else from the ordeal with Liam Hash, it's that you have to do whatever you have to do to save your own kids, no matter what the cost.